Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for June 29th, 2025, the cover story, The Weapon That Terrorizes Ukrainians by Night, How Russia's Terrifying Long-Range Drone Program Has Brought About a Deadly New Phase in the War. This article was written by C.J. Chivers. One evening in late March, Ludmila Zarutska, a vigorous woman of 80 years, left work and headed to her apartment on the left bank of the Dnipro River in Kyiv, Ukraine. A member of the cleaning staff at the city's Palace of Children and Youth, Zarutska planned to retire on April 1st. Winter's chill was easing. She had just completed her final Saturday shift and looked forward to life as a pensioner, time to begin in the warming weather of spring. Upon reaching the 9-story residential building where she lived for decades, she rode the elevator to the top floor, unlocked the steel door to her 3-bedroom apartment, and entered a space that smelled delightfully of coffee. Comfortably at home, Zarutska, who went by Luda, settled in to watch the news, as Ukrainians anxious about the war with Russia often do. Talk at the time orbited around the possibility of a ceasefire, brokered by the American President Donald Trump. Ukrainians were skeptical. While Washington pressed unfavorable terms on Ukraine, Russia ordered more troop assaults along the front and intensified attacks from afar on Ukrainian cities. Air raid alarms wailed almost every night across much of the country, followed by engine noise of long-range drones, a sound resembling dirt bikes passing overhead. Sunrises illuminated fresh destruction, wounding, or death. After watching the news, Luda spoke with her son, Mykola, by telephone. He lived near the front in Sumy, hours away by car. But the weather was tolerable and Mykola hadn't seen her in almost a week. He offered to visit that night. Luda would not have it. She reminded him that he was starting a new job in Kyiv on Monday and would then spend weeknights at her apartment. They would share much time together, she said, very soon. It was his last conversation with his mother. Her insistence almost certainly saved his life. Luda had long been lucky. Born in 1944, months after the Red Army drove Hitler's Wehrmacht from Kyiv, she survived threadbare years of reconstruction to live a good life. In the 1960s, when a new housing complex opened in an agricultural field on the left bank, she promptly moved in. It was a prime apartment with a view to Pechersk Lavra, the serenely beautiful monastery on the opposite bank's green slopes. The city built a kindergarten below her kitchen window and other schools nearby, allowing Luda to raise her son in a pleasant neighborhood outside the capital's center. Mykola became a standout basketball guard, then a junior military officer, and finally a manager in the agricultural sector of independent Ukraine. Luda doted on him throughout, cooking hearty solyanka and borscht, baking black currant pies, and putting her vintage Singer sewing machine through its paces. Decorated with colorful filigree, the machine was a utilitarian heirloom. Luda's father returned with it from Germany after World War II to present to her mother, who passed it to her. In the waning years of the Soviet Union, when fabric was more readily available than fashionable attire, Luda labored at it to make clothing for her son. She also embroidered pillows, including one with a geometric cross-stitch pattern for Mykola that she kept in the living room. According to Ukrainian tradition, the pattern protected him from harm. No one knows what Luda did in the hours after the phone call. Maybe she listened to music. She enjoyed Eric Clapton and Sting, tastes developed in the 1980s when Mykola, stationed in East Germany, brought home a tape deck and cassettes smuggled across the Iron Curtain. Maybe she brewed coffee. When the Soviet Union dissolved, one newfound pleasure was access to quality beans, which Lyuda rarely went without. However she passed the time, Mikola suspects she ultimately nodded off on the living room couch or in her bedroom a few paces away. Either location would explain how she survived the initial impact on her apartment's roof minutes after midnight of a Heron 2 drone. Heron is one of Russia's names for its domestically produced line of Shaheds, long-range attack drones of Iranian design. In current form, they measure about 11 feet long, weigh more than 400 pounds, and dive almost invisibly through night skies in carbon fiber hulls tinted black. In tiresome Orwellian fashion, Heron is also Russian for geranium, and the geranium that slammed onto the reinforced concrete ceiling of Lyuda's apartment carried a fragmenting high-explosive warhead enhanced with small tungsten alloy balls and an incendiary metallic fill. The momentum behind the strike, combined with the warhead's explosion to breach a 5-foot-wide hole into Mikola's childhood bedroom and blast the metal spheres across the space. Tungsten alloys, which are extremely dense, also possess a hardness approaching that of diamonds, making for a particularly penetrative form of shrapnel, capable of passing easily through light armor, flesh, and bone. None hit Lyuda. The room's concrete walls absorb the metal, but this weapon's creators had conceived of multiple ways to kill. Aerosolized by detonation, the drone's complementary payload of metallic microparticles and flammable oxidizer, titanium, zirconium, and barium chlorate, ignited in a fireball that whooshed out from the room, down the corridor and around corners, setting furniture and cherished things ablaze. Lyuda survived that too, but flames blocked the way to the exit, forcing her to shelter in her bedroom, separated from the burning corridor by a wooden door. Air rushed through blown-out windows, fanning an inferno. Her refuge became a concrete oven. Time was short, options few. Other than a leap to the playground 9 stories down, there was no immediate way out. News of drone impacts travel fast. As flames poured from windows, a neighbor alerted Mikola of the strike. He rang his mother 3 times. She did not answer. She could not. Silhouetted by a rolling orange glow, she stood at her bedroom window, screaming as she burned. This year, simultaneous to President Trump's calls for peace, Russia sharply escalated its strikes on Ukrainian cities, relying principally on copies of one-way Iranian drones, the same type that Iran fired across the Middle East into Israel this month. The attacks overwhelm Ukraine's air defenses to wound or kill civilians almost every night. The weapons cost little, fly far, and have made bedtime in Ukraine a time of dread. Iran first provided its drones to the Kremlin in 2022. That fall, Russia launched an average of 34 Shaheds into Ukraine per week, according to Ukrainian Air Force data analyzed by the Futures Lab at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Some attacks targeted military positions. Others hit power plants or Ukraine's electrical grid, subjecting parts of the population to lightless nights as winter gripped the steppe. The following year, when Russia began manufacturing Shaheds, the pace rose to 67 a week. It climbed gradually from there until midsummer and fall 2024, when it veered upward to 227, including decoys. Since then, the attacks have multiplied almost 5-fold to an average of 1,048 launches a week in the 6 weeks that followed Trump's push for a ceasefire in mid-February. On June 8th, Russia fired 479 long-range drones in a single night. There has not been a single uninterrupted three-day period without Shahed launches this year, said Yasir Atalan, a data fellow at the center. Civilians have faced or heard Shaheds almost every night. Russia's full invasion of Ukraine in 2022 and its occupation of roughly one-fifth of the country led to a hard pivot by both sides to drone warfare. Remarkably precise, relatively inexpensive, and operated by crews far from view, remotely operated drones have joined and even displaced long-standing conventional weapons as primary means of waging war. Rapidly evolving tactics and tools have turned Ukraine and parts of Russia and the Black Sea into live-fire test ranges for prototype tech and previously unseen killing routines. By late 2023, drones had reordered the soldiers' experience of frontline war. With Shaheds, they have come for civilians, too. As attacks have intensified, some Shaheds hit military targets, but night after night, Shaheds slam into buildings of no discernible military value, like Lyudas, prompting Ukraine to call Russia's campaign a deliberate breach of the laws of armed conflict. The use of Shahed drones by Russia violates the principle of distinction between military and civilian objects, said Andrei Hachinko, Ukraine's Deputy Minister of Justice, citing Article 51 of the Geneva Conventions. The scope and systemic execution, he argued, constitute a sustained terror campaign against non-combatants and meet the legal standard of crimes against humanity. The Russian Foreign Ministry did not reply to a question about this accusation. In its common form, a Russian-made Shahed looks like something between a flying black triangle and enormous lawn dart. The odd profile comes from a delta wing configuration built around a central fuselage that extends forward in a rounded nose. The nose contains the warhead. The tail, roughly flush with the wing flaps, holds a four-cylinder engine that spins a wooden propeller for thrust. A two-cycle mix of high-octane gasoline and oil powers the engine, a blend similar to weed whacker fuel. The hull is made of plastic, and because thin plastic can be flimsy, often the skin is sandwiched around a honeycombed cardboard stiffener. Such is the basic layout. But a combat drone must navigate and attack, which requires capacities to turn, dive, receive, and perhaps transmit digital and radio signals. So between a Shahed's nose and tail are components enabling precise maneuverability, antennas, electric servo motors, a modem, circuit boards, and more. Many are foreign-made. In this way, Iran and Russia have developed a poor man's cruise missile, a drone born of engineering informed by open market scrounging. The result can seem unimpressive. To gain flight at all, a Shahed requires an assist from a catapult or a small booster rocket that blasts it off a rack, then falls away as the drone lumbers on toward its distant destination at top speed of about 115 miles per hour. This is startlingly slow. Russia's Iskander-M ballistic missile, which it has also fired into Ukraine, flies faster than Mach 6. When Kyiv is the target, a Shahed will be vulnerable to being shot down throughout its puttering, multi-hour journey across Ukraine's airspace, hardly the stuff of Defense Expo brochures. Technical comparisons can mislead. Viewed through other lenses and with humanitarian concerns set aside, the Shahed is the rational creation of its global context. Iran and Russia have been under international sanctions for years. If necessity breeds invention, when pariah states engage in arms production, necessity also breeds cost containment, reverse engineering, and circumvention of trade barriers. Shahed's emerged from these processes to give the Kremlin a small dollar tool for projecting power and inflicting pain. Assembled in a modern industrial complex in Tatarstan, about 550 miles east of Moscow, and at a former cement plant in Ijevsk, an arms production city in the Urals, where Russia has manufactured firearms since Tsarist times, the drones fly into Ukraine carrying off-the-shelf Western and Chinese components and domestically produced warheads more powerful than those in the Iranian original. They are a physical manifestation of Russia's sanctions-evading skills, its industry's dogged adaptability, and the value of the Kremlin's sustaining partnerships with autocratic bedfellows in Tehran and Beijing, factors that cohered in an unorthodox class of weapon, built on the cheap. Russia produces Shaheds in wartime secrecy, leaving its expenditure per drone difficult for outsiders to establish. But with credible estimates of production costs currently ranging from $50,000 to $80,000 each, Shaheds arrive above cities as lethal counterpoints to big-ticket weapon systems in many military arsenals. An Iskander-M costs at least $2 million, and the longer-ranging KH-101 cruise missile runs substantially more. The disparity is immense, and manufacturing costs offer only a partial view of a weapon's full expense. Russia's ballistic and cruise missiles often launch from warships, fighter jets, or strategic bombers, which are complex systems that cost state coffers tens to hundreds of millions of dollars each, take years to manufacture, and require highly trained crews. Shaheds are different. The racks often used to fire them could be fabricated by a moderately skilled welder, and they cost less than the anti-aircraft missiles that stop them, an exchange that plays to Russia's favor every night. For the Kremlin, pressured by international sanctions and vulnerable to dips in commodity prices, the drone suggests a national arms design epiphany. Just as you don't need a Lamborghini to deliver pizza, if you want to darken lights or terrify civilians, a plastic Shahed will do. With Russian Shahed production firmly established, nights in Ukraine are heavy with fear. Mornings for many are bleary with a numbing exhaustion that anxious insomniacs know, particularly in cities like Kharkiv, right beside Russia and frequently hit. The dangers extend past to those brought by Shaheds. Russia often launches long-range drones and long-range missiles in tandem, stretching air defenses. Ballistic and cruise missiles, with their more powerful warheads, were behind recent agonizing attacks against civilians, including a strike in Sumy on Palm Sunday that killed at least 35 people, and another in April in Kryvyi Rih, home city of Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukraine's president, that killed 21 people, 9 of them children. In May, after barrages with 298 drones and 69 missiles lit Kyiv's skyline with explosions and fire, Trump rebuked his counterpart in the Kremlin. "He has gone absolutely crazy," he wrote on social media of Vladimir V. Putin. Notwithstanding that attack, in the last 5 months, drone attacks deep into Ukraine outnumbered missile attacks by a ratio of about 24 to 1, according to Adelan of the Futures Lab. The ratio is rising. Analysts suspect that Russia fires long-range drones in quantities roughly in concert with the rate its industry manufactures them. With launches now exceeding 4,000 a month, when fighting ends, any manufacturing capacity at this level would allow the Kremlin to stockpile tens of thousands of Shaheds a year. With ranges in excess of 1,000 miles, the drones could reach from Russia's borders not just to the Baltic capitals of Riga, Vilnius, and Tallinn, but also to Brussels, Berlin, and Paris. With lighter warheads, they could fly beyond. Earlier this month, Zelensky declared that Ukrainian intelligence had discovered that Russia was sharing Shahed manufacturing knowledge with North Korea. If so, that could one day mean further stockpiling of a weapon that until a few years ago was barely known to exist. "This must be addressed now," Zelensky said, "not when thousands of upgraded Shahed drones and ballistic missiles begin to threaten Seoul and Tokyo." In a written answer to questions about the Shahed program, Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs appeared to dismiss Zelensky's allegation about transferring Shahed technology to North Korea. The mildest form of commentary on such statements by the Nazi Kyiv regime is "highly unlikely," the reply read. The ministry did not answer several other questions. It then linked to a 2020 tweet by Trump in which he called the New York Times an embarrassment to journalism. For Russia, the Shahed program marks an extraordinary return on diplomatic and industrial investments and a partial rebound from stinging military and intelligence setbacks. After expecting to roll triumphantly across Ukraine in 2022, its ground forces have been plodding performers, suffering hundreds of thousands of casualties and requiring reinforcements and munitions from North Korea. To replenish ranks, the government recruits from prison and pre-trial detention centers, diverting convicts and the accused to war. Prey to anti-ship missiles and naval drones, Russia's Black Sea Fleet no longer patrols much of the Black Sea, where its flagship vessel, after absorbing two Ukrainian missiles, rests on the bottom. Stacked with squadrons of sophisticated warplanes, its air force has been unable to establish air supremacy over an adjacent nation. It also suffered consequential damage this month to as much as one-third of its strategic bombing fleet in a drone sabotage operation by the Security Service of Ukraine, or SBU. The rise of Shaheds, in contrast, demonstrates martial resilience rooted in the state's other spheres, including its sturdy manufacturing roots, which have allowed it to field a new standardized weapon fast and maintain the advantages through money and sheer mass that Russia holds over its smaller neighbor. Ukrainian intelligence officials say that in 2022, Iranian weapons moved to Russia on vessels crossing the Caspian Sea in so-called dark mode, with international maritime tracking beacons absent or switched off, and have also accused the 223rd Fleet of Flight Detachment, an air carrier affiliated with Russia's military, of importing at least 1,500 Shaheds on transport aircraft. According to the SBU, Iran dispatched Brigadier General Sharif Molisareh Abbas Musa of its Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and as many as 20 instructors to teach Russian crews Shahed use. General Musa, it added, organized many early attacks. After Shaheds began exploding in Ukraine, technical analysts went to work dissecting them. Whenever a Shahed landed without detonating or wounded or killed a person in areas under government control, first responders scoured the site. Among them were investigators from intelligence services, police units, and the Ministry of Justice, who collected what they could. What followed amounted to arms refuse necropsy. Technicians studied specimens to trace sources of components and to glean information that might be incorporated into countermeasures. They determined that early variants were assembled in Iran, but that their pedigree was mixed. Ukraine's main Directorate of Intelligence, or HUR, found the weapons contained a hodgepodge of international parts and an Iranian warhead. By 2023, Russia invested in domestic Shahed production in an industrial park in Tatarstan, run by a company called JSC Alabuga. In mid-2023, these drones began striking Ukraine, according to examinations of downed drones by Conflict Armament Research, a private arms investigation firm. Soon after that, Alabuga began producing decoy drones called Gerberas that operators launched with Shaheds to distract air defenses and consume anti-aircraft ammunition. The decoys have a foam body and cost a fraction of a Shahed. In collaboration with Chinese firms, Russia also expanded the line via production of another Shahed variant by a firm called Kupol at a plant in Eshex. It called that model Garpia, Russian for harpy. Russia declined to discuss its collaboration with Iran or China. We believe it is inappropriate for the Russian Foreign Ministry to comment on such questions, the ministry said in a statement, especially when they affect the interests of two sovereign states friendly to Russia. Much about Russian Shahed production appears to involve dubious practices. Media reports say that Alabuga's labor pool includes students as young as 15 from a vocational school, and that it lured young women from abroad with promises of training and employment in the hospitality industry, and then assigned them to drone manufacturing jobs. At least 4 women from Africa told the Associated Press that they were paid less than expected, kept under surveillance, and forced to work without adequate protective clothing. To obscure the origins of certain parts, including computer chips and carburetors, someone along the drone supply chains often obliterates components' serial numbers and markings, according to Damien Spleeters, an arms researcher who supervises the Shahed examination program for conflict armament research. The behaviors of Alabuga and Kupol have landed both companies on sanctions lists, but like their Iranian partners, they have continued to produce drones loaded with international parts, including from the United States, Switzerland, and Japan. To show up at a fresh Shahed impact site in 2025 is to encounter a shattered plastic-coated wooden propeller, a bent and dented Chinese engine, and bits and pieces identical to stock found in hardware stores, including fuel lines made of clear aquarium tubing and stainless steel hose clamps. But Russia also added design touches, resulting in more capable and powerful drones. One change was to the hull. Iran constructed Shahed airframes in a light gray hue, inclining almost to white. Russia switched to a black model for night attacks. Composed of fiberglass and reinforced with woven carbon fibers, these newer hulls were stronger. This material is very durable, not like the Iranian one, said Andriy Kolchitsky, deputy head of the Military Research Center at Kyiv Scientific Research Institute of Forensic Expertise. Other enhancements followed. By late 2023, Shaheds carried tungsten alloy balls. Tungsten alloys are contained in munitions produced by sophisticated arms manufacturers, including a version of the American HIMARS precision-guided rocket, as well as tank projectiles used by Israel and the United States. Russia found a quick means to add them to cheap drones, sometimes simply wrapping them in rubbery sheaths around the warhead. Russia has also begun to swap in domestically made Kometa satellite navigation antennas, which resist jamming and are used in many of its other precision weapons. By 2025, Ukrainian technicians identified at least 5 different warheads in Russian Shaheds, including thermobaric incendiary and high explosive charges in fragmenting steel cases of various weights. By this spring, some were as large as 90 kilograms, almost 200 pounds. The drone's navigation systems also underwent changes or testing. Some Shaheds have carried modems and Ukrainian SIM cards, which connect to cellular networks. Recent models carried multiple cards, apparently to hop to a new phone number if a connection drops. One theory proposes that these drones use cellular networks to navigate and share in-flight position data with command centers to help Russian targeting teams evaluate which routes best evade defenses. If so, this would effectively allow drones that reach targets to show others the way. Russia also appears to salt the waves with specialized Shaheds. These include specimens with cameras, perhaps flown remotely via goggles by pilots in Russia, which Ukrainian intelligence officials presume are used for target surveillance or assessing strike damage. Research and development happen in real time. A problem we are having with Shaheds is they are making changes faster than we can report them, Spleeters said. It's hard to keep up. I would like to now take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. One sure way to prevent Russia from refining attack routes is to stop Shaheds long before they reach targets. To do so, Ukraine maintains layered, frequently shifting defenses. Among them are anti-aircraft missile batteries, helicopters and fixed-wing planes that fly interception missions, machine gun teams and air defense artillery crews firing from trucks and small boats and troops with shoulder-fired heat-seeking missiles, including the American-designed Stinger. Ukraine also spoofs Shaheds with transmitters feeding false GPS signals to lead them off course, and it severs cellular service to phone numbers moving across the country on speeds and routes that only a drone could take, cutting live navigational links. Among the many innovations is a unit called Darknode, part of the Unmanned Systems Forces 412th Nemesis Regiment, which is armed with anti-Shahed drones. The secretive unit joined the fighting this year. Days after Luda died, the unit began its nightly work in the minutes before darkness when four Ukrainian soldiers in a vehicle eased to a stop on a dirt road between soggy fields. Ukraine's expansive tracts of sunflower and wheat can feel oceanic, and these fields, set back from the border with Russia, formed a flat plain of budding vegetation punctuated by occasional windbreaks of trees. The soldiers stepped out into the cool air. Cows mooed in the distance. The sweet odor of manure floated by. One soldier knelt to the dark soil, tore up a tuft of grass, and dropped a few blades, observing which way they drifted on the breeze. Wind direction would influence launch. Working quickly, the soldiers lifted green crates from their vehicle and opened them, revealing their weapons. The drones, whose name and technical specifications remain classified, were prototypes of a once futuristic concept now in regular service in Ukraine. Drone-on-drone aerial warfare. After assembly, each would climb high into the sky to hunt Russian drones. Conceived as an affordable means of countering Shaheds, they would be flown by Kriklow, Darknode's ace, who was recruited into his unusual role after his mastery of video games, including Grand Theft Auto, translated smoothly into flying drones. The soldiers formed a squad operating under the call sign Chaika, Ukrainian for seagull, and followed routines not seen before in war. Maxim, a sapper, and Sergeant Oleksandr, the squad leader, assembled launch equipment. Ole, the navigator, set up antennas on tripods. Next, the squad armed the drones and proceeded with operational checks. While Maxime clutched the drone so it would not leap forward, the motor emitted a screaming whirr, a telltale audio signature of this war. Satisfied, Kirlo switched off the drone. Darkness settled over the fields. From the nearest village, a dog barked nonstop. A computer monitor illuminated the soldiers' faces and displayed a national radar feed. It showed that the sky was free of incoming drones. Kirlo knew it was early. The squad's enemies were beyond the horizon, across the border, most likely loading Shaheds and Gerberas onto racks. The soldiers talked softly, waiting for drones they expected soon. The pattern was well known. Russia usually launched Shaheds after dark in sequence to barrages from several different directions. The attack that killed Liuda was typical. Multiple Russian units, each regarded as elite, operated Shaheds. That evening, over about 2 hours, three units launched drones inside Russia targeting Kyiv, according to the HUR. Shortly before 6 p.m., the 45th Separate Special Purpose Brigade sent the first wave from Bryansk. 35 minutes later, the 1st Reconnaissance Strike UAV Squadron of Grom Kaskad, a Russian drone brigade, fired a barrage from Milirova, a base in the Rostov region. Grom Kaskad includes sons of wealthy Russians and Russian politicians and operates far back from front lines. A little after 7:30 p.m., a group from the 924th State Center for Unmanned Aviation, which is central to Russia's Shahed program, launched a salvo from Kursk. Ukraine's Air Force said Russia also flew drones that night from Primorsk-Artoksk, which is across the Sea of Azov, and from Primorsk, a Ukrainian city under Russian occupation. The barrages included 147 drones, the Air Force said, 122 Shaheds and 25 decoys. The straight-line distances from launch to Kyiv ranged from about 250 miles to almost 500. But Shaheds and the decoys accompanying them rarely fly straight lines for long. They follow meandering flight plans that sometimes almost circle back on their routes while winding their way to programmed destinations. This is why the drones that survived Ukraine's defenses were in the air for roughly 5 or 6 hours before one slammed onto Lyuda's home. Ukrainian radar detects the incoming weapons, both to alert civilians and for interception. Paired with nationwide alarm systems, including air raid sirens and free mobile phone apps, the radar effectively warns residents of threats and helps defending soldiers choose their positions. The system has generally worked well. From 2022 until early this April, fewer than 6% of drones made it through, according to an analysis by Adelan. But when Shaheds fly in multiple waves and with new technology or tactical adaptations, more can reach targets. During the week Liuda died, 121 Shaheds slipped by, damaging infrastructure and wounding or killing civilians almost nightly. The trend lines are gloomy. This May, as attacks intensified, almost 20% of launched drones flew past defenses to land with blasts of shrapnel and flame. The dragon, Hychenko said, becomes more cruel. Almost simultaneous to Lyuda's death, another Shahed dove from the sky over Ukraine's capital toward Emmanuel Church, Kyiv, a busy religious center on the Dnipro River's right bank. It was 12 minutes after midnight on a Sunday during Lent, the period of spiritual reflection before Easter. Many worshippers had spent Saturday at the church preparing for service the next morning. Among them were Oleskandra Haranska, 26, her husband Sasha, 35, and their 5-year-old daughter Nicole. The family previously owned an apiary with more than 3,000 beehives near Orkiv, a town in Ukraine's southeast. In a region of sunflower fields, the bees produced an abundance of honey, with which Oleksandra opened a small confectionery baking cakes. The couple were devout. A soprano and pianist, Oleksandra sang in the choir in Emmanuel Church or Kyiv and volunteered in its youth ministry. Sasha, an assistant pastor, served as an unofficial military chaplain. As Russian invaders advanced in 2022, rumbling across the steppe toward Orakhiv, Sasha visited Ukrainian troops at local checkpoints, offering gratitude and encouragement while sharing coffee, tea, and his wife's gingerbread, sweetened with honey jarred by his own hands. Often he invited them to join in prayer. Many were not believers. Some mocked him. Sasha, an evangelist, was undeterred. For 6 months he visited bunkers, a routine he sustained into 2023 when Russian artillery moved closer. As Orakhiv shuddered under shelling, Sasha's ministry gained acceptance. Huddled in dugouts as projectiles screamed through the air and exploded around the countryside, troops stopped teasing their persistent pastor. They accepted his blessings and asked when he might return. When fighting reached the farmland where the beehive stood, war idled Sasha and Oleksandra's businesses. They kept working, distributing humanitarian aid from the church. Shelling grew more intense. A frontline town was no place for Nicole, who was 3. The family relocated to Kyiv, along with Oleksandra's younger sister, Natalia. In the capital, the family found sanctuary in Emmanuel Church Kyiv, a community of almost 1,000 people. Oleksandra joined its 50-member musical cast and baked desserts each Saturday evening ahead of Sunday service. Nicole joined Sunday school. A strong-willed girl, she resisted her parents' urges to wear sweaters or jeans. She preferred dresses, which she complemented with a tiny toy crown. In a time of violence and dislocation, having lived under frightening blasts, Nicole approached her wardrobe as if she might control what she could. She was a bright, singular presence. People referred to her as Emmanuel Church's own Disney princess, a small, bold child. That Saturday evening was bonding. Nicole announced that she wanted to build a gingerbread house. "Mama, let's make one," she said. Her timing was good. Utensils and baking supplies were spread about. Oleksandra set aside work. Mother and daughter assembled a small house, lightly coated in white frosting. The night ran late, and at 10 p.m. they agreed to finish decorating their project the next day. Oleksandra carried Nicole to a 3-room wooden building on church grounds where volunteers working into the night often slept. She tucked in Nicole and returned to baking while Sasha watched their daughter. When she rejoined the family later, the couple lay down beside Nicole for sleep. A short while later, Oleksandra became aware that she was in circumstances she did not understand. She was walking unsteadily in her underwear in an almost lightless room. She had not seen this place before. Her hips and pelvis panged sharply. 3 teeth were cracked. Her upper arms were cut and deeply bruised. Her left hand throbbed. Skin on her back had been scraped away. Blood beaded and seeped. She seemed intuitively that she was not dreaming. The pain was too real, the surroundings too tangible. But she could not recall arriving in this strange place, much less the origins of her wounds. "Maybe I've been kidnapped," she thought, but was not sure. She had no idea of even time. Feeling cold, she dropped to the floor. Alone, enveloped in darkness, she passed out. Minutes passed. Oleksandra woke and tried to stand. Pain forbade movement. She passed out again. She returned to semi-consciousness as flashlights approached. A man shouted, "She's here!" Oleksandra recognized voices. Vitali, a pastor, and Serhii, the young man who maintained the church grounds. Words lifted confusion's veil. "A shahed had destroyed their shelter," Vitali said. and Sasha was dead. With that, Oleksandra Horonska re-entered the world. The Shahed had carried a 110-pound warhead identical to the one that killed Liuda on the other side of the river. Its explosion blew asunder the room in which her family nestled, heaving Oleksandra over a now-shattered wall to the lot next door, where her impact broke teeth, cracked her pelvis, and tore skin. She regained her feet, staggered to the nearest building, pushed open a door, and collapsed in a storeroom. There she entered a liminal state, slipping in and out of consciousness for almost an hour. Now, warm hands touched her. Serhii covered her with a blanket. She was saved. Rescuers rushed her past smoldering rubble to a hospital, where after stabilization and surgery, she woke from anesthesia the next day to hear that Nicole, too, was dead. In composition, Dark Note is typical of Ukraine's armed forces. After more than 3 years of war, the country fields the second largest military in Europe, behind only Russia's in size. It has built this force through mass mobilization that exempts men younger than 25 from conscription, creating groups of soldiers much older than those of Western nations, and lending units a seasoned character. Before Russia sent combat divisions over the border in 2022, Oleksandr, 37, was an archaeologist at the National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. Ole, 31, supervised shifts at a plant that manufactures Volkswagen parts. Maxime, 36, was a tailor with a side hustle printing logos on hoodies and t-shirts. The trio joined Ukraine's ground forces before moving to the unmanned systems forces upon its formulation in 2024. They followed a commander, Second Lieutenant Oleksandr Yarmak, into Dark Node, which Yarmak leads. Yarmak, a successful and widely followed rapper, ranks among Ukraine's better-known performing artists. In Babylon, a track he released in 2024, he vented disgust over an ominous beat at Russia's long-range drones and the soldiers deploying them. There are those who rejoice in launching a Shahed into a child's bedroom, he rapped, half a world away from home, brutalized from birth, thirsty for blood, just true evil. Bitterness flows both ways. Russians often pen messages in white ink on the cold, dark fuselages of Shaheds, including on the nose of a drone that landed in Ukraine intact. "Good morning, faggots," it read. As the commander of a new unit, Yarmak leads multiple squads. They are a second generation of drone operators to engage in air-to-air drone war. Pilots from the SBU used first-person view drones last year to down two Russian helicopters. Other drone teams chased and struck Russian aerial surveillance drones and shorter-range kamikaze drones known as Lancets. Stopping Shaheds with drones was a natural next step, and Yarmak said it offered advantages over certain other methods. Chief among them, an anti-Shahed drone could trail behind its target until the safest moment to destroy it without risking collateral harm, as when a damaged Shahed knocked off course falls to a village. "We can follow a Shahed until it is past a settlement," Yarmak said, "and detonate it over unpopulated fields. Moreover, the technology rapidly improves. Unlike many older weapon systems, including anti-aircraft machine guns, interceptor drones are rapidly evolving. Dark Node was experimenting with different models." "This is an ongoing process," Yarmak said. "Our ultimate goal is to make these drones fully autonomous." Hitting Shaheds presented more challenges than hitting reconnaissance drones. Shaheds fly almost exclusively at night and much faster than the drones that Ukraine previously downed. The unmanned systems forces worked with drone designers to develop mini aircraft capable of ranges extending far past the horizon, high altitudes and airspeeds faster than their quarry's 115 miles per hour. These models cost about $6,000 each. To find pilots, Yarmak scoured the service's training center for prospects. There he found Kirilo, who enlisted in September 2024, just as Shahed attacks surged. Kirilo was a graphic designer from Donetsk who lived under Russian occupation until 2019. Before his oath, he owned a DJI Mavic, a quadcopter in widespread civilian use, and trained on digital flight apps. He joined at 29 intending to become a drone pilot. "I understood the skills I have fit perfectly into the profession," he said, "and I understand the impact a pilot can have is pretty high." His impact has been undeniable. In the first week of Dark Note's participation in the fighting, its squads shot down 22 drones. Kirilo accounted for 12 hits. As he waited for a fresh volley of Shaheds, a monitor showed live and archived radar feeds. Straight lines indicated paths of the day's glide bombs, heavy air-to-ground munitions released by Russian aircraft that carry a strapped-on package of welded wings and a navigation system. Their glide paths clustered in dense parallel lines from inside Russia to impacts along the border between Sumy and Kursk, where Ukrainian troops were dug in. No Shaheds were visible on screen. "It is like fishing. Much depends on luck," Alexander said. Some positions ended up on flight paths of more Shaheds than others, and each night might be different. After the Shahed killed Linda Zrutska, Mykola rushed to Kyiv. He scaled the staircase and slipped past the open door, stepping through an acrid smell onto a crunching carpet of wet ash. Before him was his former home. The loss was total. Firefighters had knocked down and doused the fire, but save for blackened pots and other metal bits, almost everything Lyuda owned was destroyed. Her sewing machine, its brightly painted finish charred away, rested on a soggy mound in his childhood bedroom beneath a gaping hole in the ceiling. Rain drizzled in. Small circular holes dotted walls, the marks of shrapnel. Pieces of black fuselage were scattered about. Mykola was familiar with sights like these. 6 months earlier, a Shahed landed in the garden beside his mother-in-law's house in Sumy. Its explosion left a large crater, broke windows, damaged the roof, and showered the area with drones' broken pieces. He cleaned up the mess. Now he made his way to the living room. Family photo albums, his athletic trophies, the flat-screen TV he bought and programmed to his mother's favorite channels, the pillow she embroidered to protect him from harm, all had burned or melted into indistinguishable black heaps. Usually when Mykola visited, he slept on the living room couch. There was no couch. Flames had consumed it, just as they might have consumed him had his mother not urged him not to bother with the drive. Eyes reddened, voice measured. He wondered aloud why Russia, in possession of more land than any other nation, was intent on claiming Ukraine and willing to attack apartment buildings to do so. "Still, the bastards want more," he said. A former Soviet military officer, he knew well a certain way of thinking, a blend of pride and greed, found among the masters of Ukraine's neighbors to the east. They envied the fact, he said, that they could live better than they did. Behind him was a small balcony. Since childhood, when Mykola left for school or trips, his mother saw him off by waving from its railing as he crossed the courtyard below. The rituals of motherhood are strong. When he visited the week before, Lyuda waved from there. Across the river, Oleksandra Harantska awaited pelvic reconstruction surgery in a hospital with her mother and sister at her side. Government investigators and Emmanuel Church pastor Pavlo Tupchik had pieced together what happened and gently briefed her. Two Shaheds fell beside the church 1 minute apart. The second hit the asphalt a few yards from the room where she and her family had laid down for sleep. Its explosion cut a crater into the ground and radiated a wave of overpressure that sheared away the entire room and threw much of its contents, including three occupants, to the property next door. The blast killed Sasha and Nicole instantly, according to an investigator for the SBU. Their mattress landed atop the building's roof, 20 feet up. How the overpressure and flame and metal balls did not kill Oleksandra, no one knew, but she flew in a slightly different direction, landed alive, and was propelled by adrenaline to move away from the rising fires. No matter her broken pelvis, she staggered to the building's storeroom where rescuers found her unconscious almost an hour later, after presuming her dead. Her survival, she said, was a miracle creditable to the will of God. Maybe I know something or have something inside that God still wants use here on earth, she said. She would spend the season in physical therapy. Once she could walk again, she said she would start a new ministry, perhaps with sports, music, and art. This, she said, is the path of healing. Oleksandra's first operation succeeded, allowing the church to host a funeral service for Sasha and Nicole in mid-April. A church is not its buildings, and as it happened, because of the particular layout of the Emmanuel Church grounds, well-wishers gathered between the two Shahed impact sites, which the worshippers had fastidiously cleaned up. A portrait of Sasha holding Nicole stood before caskets of mismatched size. Oleksandra sat in a white robe with a bandaged left hand. She had tried to make sense of an attack on a church, but could not summon a satisfying explanation. Bereft of husband and child, learning to walk for a second time, she put conjecture aside. I'm certain that there are questions we just will not get answers to, she said, not here on earth. On other matters, she chose faith as her guide, drawing from Romans 12:19. I know one thing, whoever did this, they touched the apple of God's eye, and it will not go unanswered, she said. From my side, I forgive those who did this, even though humanly speaking it is impossible to forgive. But I know what God said. Leave vengeance to me. Thank you very much for joining me for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.